the altar, there's a beautiful picture. I don't know if you noticed it or not. You probably did, but if you didn't, you might want to just glance. It's a picture of Mahaprajapati, who is our first woman ancestor. It's said that she lived to be 120 years old. And Prajapati means leader of the assembly, Mahaprajapati being great leader of the assembly. And when the person who became the Buddha, the founder of all these teachings, Siddhartha Gautama, when he was 1 week old, his mom died. He was a motherless child. And the sister of his mother, whose name was Prajapati, took him as her own. So one way we can talk about Mahaprajapati is she was Buddha's foster mother. She was also his aunt. And she raised him. She suckled him. She fed him. She raised him to be the fine young man who we've come to call the Buddha. And she was also a teacher in her own right. When, he left the palace, he left his family, he went out into the world and desired to understand what it's all about, why we suffer. And after his great awakening experience, when he returned down the mountain, she was one of the first people who said, your teaching, this is good teaching. I want to practice this way. I want to practice the Buddha Dharma. So she was his foster mother. She was his aunt. She was also one of his first students. And she was also a great teacher in her own right. It is said that she had 500 women who eventually were part of her order, her assembly. There's a poem that actually came down through the centuries that she wrote. It's in the book that's called the Theragata, which are translations and commentary on the Theragata. It's a collection of writings by the first women Buddhist practitioners in India. And this is a poem that she that was recorded that she said, "Homage to you, Buddha, best of all creatures who set me and many others free from pain. All pain is understood. The cause, the craving, is dried up. The noble eightfold way unfolds. I have reached the state where everything stops. I have been mother, son, father, brother, grandmother. Knowing nothing of the truth, I journeyed on. But I have seen the Blessed One. This is my last body, and I will not go from birth to birth again. Look at all the disciples, all together, their energy, their sincere effort. This is homage to the Buddhas. Maya," that's Buddha's mom, "gave birth to Gautama for the sake of us all. She has driven back the pain of the sick and the dying." So, if this was a different world, I would now reach for one of the many, many books that were written about the teachings of the great Mahaprajapati. I would read the stories that were told about her teachings and that were recorded through the ages. I would have so many books to choose from. And I would read about all the great women ancestors who practiced alongside with the men and who are recorded here and there in the canon. But I would have hundreds of books to draw from, to read to you from, and talk to you about their stories and their teachings and their students. But this is not that world. This is a world where it is only in the last 20 years that the teachings of women have been, are begin to be being collected are beginning to be found, that scholars are beginning to poke through all the stories and draw out the stories of the women teachers and the women ancestors. This is a world where it is only in the last 10 or 20 years where there are any officially recognized women ancestors in our Soto Zen lineage. Those of you who have the Rakusu, who have taken the lay ordination, for those of you who are new, those are the blue little aprons that people are wearing. And those who have taken the priest ordination vows, the black Rakusus and the black robes, and those who have the brown, you get a lineage paper when you get ordained, be it lay or priest. It's all the same here. And on that lineage paper, there's the names of, on mine, there's 92 names. And the first name is the 92nd name. The first name of a woman is the 92nd name. And that's Catherine Thanis, our abbot. So it's really her generation, Blanche Hartman in San Francisco, and some of the other women who received transmission from the first generation of the male Japanese teachers who came to America, Maizumi Roshi, Katagiri Roshi, who began to ordain women in the official lineage of the ancestors. So in 200 years, when our students, your students, my students, our grandchildren's grandchildren, are those of them who find their way to the Buddha Way, when they get their lineage papers, they'll go, wow, isn't that interesting? Look, all the way down. Oh, here's where we began to integrate our male and our female ancestors. How interesting that is. So we're very, very fortunate to be in this time, to be in this generation, this pioneering generation, to have our teachers have been the pioneers that they are. Now, why was this? Well, how did this happen? It's not that there weren't women teachers. As we know, we honor Mahapajapati, and there's many, many women who are described in this wonderful book, The First Buddhist Women. There's a great book called Zen Women, which Grace Shearson organized, which has stories of many fine Buddhist women teachers. Bodhidharma transmitted to a woman. One of his heirs was female. Kazan transmitted to had a female disciple. Dogen had many, many strong women in his temple and his lineage. So it's not that the women weren't out there and they weren't practicing. And it's not that there's anything in the Buddha Dharma that says that women shouldn't be equal practitioners. So it was just because of limited understanding. It was just because of discrimination. That this is so. The view that somehow women were inferior and weren't able to receive the Dharma transmission and who's weren't worthy of having their words written down and through the ages and couldn't become ordained and couldn't practice with men and had to practice in separate practice places. And so we have to this is part of our lineage. This is part of our heritage, this fact. And if you try to, how do we practice with it then? That becomes a question. It's a koan that I've been chewing on since Kokyo invited me to speak about women's practice, Mahapajapati. It's like you have to deal with it one way or the other if you are invited to speak about women's practice. Because, you know, to just talk about women's practice like those of us here, it's pretty simple. It's just, well, we come and we sit zazen and we do service and we, you know, we give talks and we listen to talks and we practice together. You know, that's women's practice. But when we really try to look at it deeply, I think we have to somehow find a way of working with this fact of this discrimination. So there's a variety of ways that I've encountered in this study that I've been doing to practice with this discrimination. One way is to deny that it exists. That is basically the idea, well, because the Buddha Dharma is empty of gender, because there is no gender in the Buddha Dharma, the teachings of emptiness, the Four Noble Truths, all the ways that we learn about the teachings of the Buddha, it's not about gender, it's about liberation, it's about suffering, and it's about finding our truth, and it's about releasing the grip of our conceptual minds. It's empty of gender. So some would say because it's empty of gender, it's therefore misguided and deluded to point out discrimination. That's one argument you'll hear. Another one is to get mad at the people who bring it up. That also is a kind of an interesting line of discourse that you can find if you study this, where people argue, Buddhists like argue about this. How dare you imply that our ancestors were somehow limited in their, perhaps in their understanding? Isn't that blasphemy? And then there's the feminist scholarly analysis. If you're interested in a fabulous look at the whole kit and caboodle, I would recommend Rita Gross's book, Buddhism After Patriarchy. It's very, very, very thorough look at this whole issue. But actually, I don't really want to talk about that. I just take it for granted. It's a simple thing for me when I think about it. It's just, you know, they were just limited in their view, and somehow they thought it was okay that 50% of the human race was excluded from the formal practice. So what I actually decided that I really wanted to focus on were two things, and that's what I'm going to talk about. Not that one can't have very interesting discussions about these other aspects, but what I really want to do is I really want to pay homage to the ancestors, some of the ancestors in our lineage, who made it their business to make room for equality of practice of female and male together, because they didn't have a problem with this concept that because in the ultimate there is no gender, therefore we shouldn't try to change things in the relative world. They worked in the relative world to right the wrong. I don't want to talk about them. I want to honor them, because the first such ancestor was great teacher Mahapajapati, and her actions are a great teaching for us, as well as the actions of Shakyamuni Buddha and Ananda. So the first thing I want to do is talk about Mahapajapati and Ananda and Shakyamuni Buddha and how they practiced together to awaken together about this issue that was to persist through and to this day. Though, like I said, fortunately, in this particular lineage, in the Suzuki Roshi Soto Zen lineage, there may be still individual aspects of discrimination. There still may be the whole kind of cultural stuff, but formally, there is no institutionalized discrimination in our lineage. There's women are abbots, women are transmitted to, women transmit. We just had two of our Sangha members receive transmission from a female transmitted teacher. So we're lucky. So I want to pay homage to some of our ancestors. And I also want to talk about what I think is kind of maybe a bigger and deeper, and for me, where I practice with this issue, which is just the opportunity that diversity offers us, all the different ways that we are diverse, not just our gender diversity, but all the ways that we are diverse, our ages. In this very room, we have a great diversity of age and life experience. Our diversities of class, of race, of sexual orientation, the different works that we do or don't do. I believe that our diversity is actually a profound source of richness, and that the problem is when we make it a problem, when we make diversity something about which to discriminate in a suppressive way. But actually, our diversity is a liberative aspect of our humanity. So that's also how I'd like to honor Mahapajapati tonight and speak about that. So Buddha, Mahapajapati, you know, right away she began to practice very, very, very seriously. She just dedicated her life to the practice of Buddha's teachings. She got it, she loved it, and she started to... So back then, nowadays, you know, we practice where some of us stay home and practice the way, and others leave home and practice the way. But back then it was really about home leaving was kind of the... That's what the disciples of Buddha were called, the home leavers. They left and went out to... And were in the greater Sangha out in the community. So Mahapajapati requested of Buddha, she said, well, we should have women should also be able to leave home. Basically, we should have a women's order as well. And he says, nope, no way. Not going to do that. And I'm not going to do the long version of the story. I'm going to do the short version, because if you're interested in this, you can read about it. So, you know, she kept practicing, and she attracted more followers, women. They say that many of her original Sangha were the wives and lovers of the home leavers. You know, the men went off and were practicing the Buddha Dharma, and the women were like, we want to practice too. And some women left a home of their own accord. They didn't need to be attached to a man to do that. They got it and they wanted to practice. So Mahapajapati kept trying. She kept asking her dear nephew and her teacher, please, you know, we want to have a women's order. We should have a women's order. Nope. No, 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 no. He was set on it. He was set against it. No way. And this went on for quite some time. And then finally, she and her fellow practitioners, they just shaved their heads and they put on the robes and they walked barefoot. They basically claimed, they said, you know, I mean, the way I take that is, I'm not really asking you for your permission. I am, you know, I am. I don't need you to give me permission. But she was still functioning in the limits of the time. So they shaved their heads, they put on the saffron robes, and barefoot they walked to again petition Shakyamuni Buddha, please. It's, you know, here we are, you know, please acknowledge us. Nope, won't do that, he said. So Ananda, Buddha's beloved disciple, who I think also was their cousin. These guys were like family, which is kind of an interesting sideline. But Ananda saw this, you know, saw this dedication and this devotion, and he went to Buddha and he said, and I'm paraphrasing here, he said, well, are you saying that, can women realize the Buddha Dharma? And Buddha said, of course they can. And he said, well, then why can't they have their own order? And Buddha said, okay, but they have to have special rules. And Mahapajapati said, okay, I'm there. Special rules, no problem. Got their order. All right. Now, there's, again, if you read about these things, some will criticize, oh, you know, she sold out, you know, she accepted the special rules, which were things like, you know, even the most senior woman has to bow down and serve and acquiesce to the lowest man. Like a man who had just started practice would be senior to, say, Mahapajapati. That was one of the rules. Or a monk can't visit a dying nun on her deathbed. So there were a variety of special rules like that. So skillful means, Mahapajapati accepted them, but then she immediately, well, not maybe immediately, but she started trying to contest them. And he didn't agree to change them. However, it is said that when she lay dying, she said, you know, I want my nephew, I want Buddha, I want you to come to my deathbed. And he did. And by doing so, thereby, he himself challenged one of the special rules. So this spirit is reflected, I believe, in the beautiful echo. I wasn't able to come to the ceremony this morning that was chanted for Mahapajapati, the memorial ceremony that was chanted this morning. But in the dedication, I think that these words really speak to this quality that this story shares with us as one of the ways that we can practice with the difficulties of discrimination that we may encounter, because all of these are teaching stories for us, that we can practice. I'll just read this. From the brightness beyond female and male, the Buddha's foster mother, Acharya Mahapajapati, appeared in this world with compassion and wisdom, vast and wide, establishing the wholeness of the home leaver's way. With red heart and steadfast resolve, she encourages beings to find their own voice and realize the Buddha Dharma. May her pure pioneer practice and devotion dissolve barriers to understanding and awareness. And the other thing that I just want to point out about this before I talk about another one of our ancestors who has a commentary about this issue is a point that actually is made in Rita Gross's book, where she says, you know, people will go and will analyze, you know, was Buddha sexist because he said no so many times, and oh, it was because of the culture, and you know, there's all sorts of different ways you can look at it, different interpretations, or people who defend it. You know, there's whole Buddhist orders that still, you know, will defend and try to justify the discrimination against women. You know, women all over the world are still working for the equality in the Buddha way, or not in the Buddha way, but in the cultural adaptations of it. But I think Rita Gross's point that what is most helpful about this story for us, and I really, really agree with this, is the thing to notice is that Buddha changed his mind. This is really what's helpful for us. He changed his mind. You know, do we get mad at him because he wasn't perfect? Or do we get mad at him? Do we get mad at each other because we have the limitations that we have, that we're bound by the causes and conditions and the cultural influences of our time? Do we get mad at each other, or do we give each other the opportunity to awaken, which is what Mahapajapati did with her persistent presencing of her commitment and her vow? And what Ananda, I think, very skillfully did was he basically used the Buddha Dharma and the ultimate emptiness of the Buddha Dharma with Buddha to say, look, if you're saying that, of course, all beings can awaken, then how can you rectify that with the way you're practicing in the relative? He made him integrate the ultimate and the relative of his own teaching, and Buddha saw that, and he changed his mind. That's all it takes. We just have to change our mind. So here's another ancestor. And let me tell you, this really surprised me. Dogen. I don't know whether you know it or not. I didn't before I started studying this. But Dogen has this amazing fascicle, I guess it is, in the Shobogenzo, which is the collection of the great teachings of Dogen. And Dogen is the founder of our particular type of Zen that we practice here, and he practiced in the 13th century, and he has this it's called the Rai Hai Tokuzue, receiving the marrow by bowing, and it's basically a whole writing where he completely challenges directly and in a quite modern language, I think, challenges the discrimination against women practitioners. And he does it in a Dogen-ish way. So it's really quite amazing. I wanted to just share a little bit about from this with you. So one of the things he does, here he is, and he's, you know, directly challenging that special rule by this writing here. Oh, he first of all, he opens the writing by just writing about a bunch of really great women teachers in our lineage. And then he says, here's one. When Zhao Zhou, who would later become great master Zhenji of the Tang dynasty, aroused the aspiration for enlightenment and was about to begin a journey, he said to himself, I will ask about Dharma of anyone who surpasses me, even a seven-year-old. I will teach anyone who is behind me, even a 100-year-old. When asking a seven-year-old about Dharma, an old man like Zhao Zhou bows. It is an extraordinary aspiration, the mind art of an old Buddha. It is an excellent custom of study that when a nun has attained the way, attained Dharma and started to teach, monks who seek Dharma and study join her assembly, bow to her, and ask about the way. It is just like finding water at a time of thirst. And amazingly, I look at the clock and I'm like, is that really true? Is it really that time? So I'm going to just skip and read one more part from Dogen because I really want to get to part two of this talk. He really goes out there here. He goes, if you vow for a long time not to look at women, do you leave out women when you vow to save sentient, numberless sentient beings? If you do so, you are not a bodhisattva. How can you call it the Buddha's compassion? This is merely nonsense spoken by a soaking drunk shravaka. Take that. Humans and devas should not believe in such a practice. If you exclude those who have broken precepts, you may exclude all bodhisattvas. If you exclude those who may break precepts in the future, you may exclude all bodhisattvas who arouse the aspiration for enlightenment. If you exclude them in such a way, you need to exclude everyone. Then how can Buddha Dharma be actualized? To make such vows is the mad intention of fools who don't know Buddha Dharma. It should be lamented. So there's a whole lot more of that in here, in that fascicle in the Shobogenzo, if that is of interest to you. And the last ancestor that I would just like to honor in this kind of part one of this talk is Suzuki Roshi. Because he did exactly what Shakyamuni Buddha did, was he had a moment of choice and he just changed his mind. So it was a story that's told in The Crooked Cucumber, which is the biography of Suzuki Roshi's life. And it's the discussion when Richard Baker, who was Suzuki Roshi's, one of his students, and Suzuki Roshi were talking about Tassajara. They were just on the verge of buying Tassajara Monastery. And they were talking about whether women and men should be able to practice together at Tassajara. And while there may be a lot of benefit, I think, sometimes for having women practicing just with women and men just with men, I'm not saying I don't think that's a good idea. In this particular case, they were considering what would be the impact of segregating the sexes at Tassajara. So here's what they talked about. Before anyone had gone down to Tassajara, Suzuki and Richard had considered the prospect of having a monastery with men and women living and practicing together. There had been some talk of having separate practice periods for men and women, but it never went very far. Many of Suzuki's students were couples who both practiced, obviously heterosexual in this instance, and some of his strongest students were women. Richard said he wanted his wife and daughter to be able to spend time with him there, at least in the summer. He also thought it would be harder to raise money to buy Tassajara if it wasn't co-ed. He was ever the businessman. Suzuki had no experience with women in a monastic setting. But he was willing to try. No women, no Tassajara, Richard summed it up. And Suzuki threw out a 2,500-year-old tradition. You just change your mind. get over it. But what I actually think is the next layer to peel back about this subject is I think that we limit ourselves if we just talk about it as male, female, gender. I find it more helpful to think about it in terms of yin and yang. The energy of yin and yang, which comes from Taoism, which actually is one of the ancestral roots of Zen. Zen is the marriage of Indian Buddhism meeting Chinese Taoism, gave birth to Zen. And so the idea of yin and yang, of heaven and earth, of the opposites that are not polarized, but that actually create the entire world. The world is made up of heaven and earth, and all of us contain both elements in ourselves. So there's a way that this separation of male, female, and pathologizing it and discriminating, I think really it's very sad because it limits the opportunities that we have as humans to benefit from each other's varied ways that we embody the qualities of yin and yang. And we tend to think, yin, that's woman, and yang is man. But actually, I know plenty of female-bodied people who are quite yang, and many male-bodied people who are quite yin, and transgendered people who mix both. And I think that it's one way that we can look at the dynamic interplay of what we think of as opposites. The dynamic interplay of yin and yang, I think, is present right in the story of the awakening of Shakyamuni Buddha. So I want to just tell that story from this perspective that I'm inviting us to look at, and then I think I need to open up for your comments as I look at the clock. So, the story of Shakyamuni Buddha is that he left his palace. He was very privileged. He lived in privilege and wanted to go outside of the walls, wanted to break out, bust out, go out and see the world. One could say that's kind of a positive aspect of yang, the energy in all of us that seeks to go out, open to the heaven, to the big world. So off he went, and he met up with the prevalent practitioners of the time, who were people who believed that by mortifying the body, they believed that the body was bad, and that you needed to mortify the body in order to attain enlightenment. And so they starved themselves and did very severe physical practices. And he became very adept at it. He was good, a good student. He became kind of a bag of bones, skin and bones. He was starving. And a woman from the village came up and saw him and, it's kind of like, oh, you poor starving man, here. Would you like this rice pudding? And he said, oh, yeah, I do. I'd like that rice pudding. So I think this is maybe too much yang opening to being rebalanced by yin, by nourishment. Too much yang. Oh, I don't have a body. I'll starve to death, but I don't have a body. The grounding element of the nourishing one, yin. Here, eat. And he did, and he was criticized for it by his fellers. It's like, he's weak. He's eating. But actually, that was the foundation of the middle way, because Buddha realized, no, it's not about indulgence. And but it's also not about mortification. There's something in between, and I'm going to sit down under this tree until I realize what is this path that is the middle way, not completely here, not completely there, but this middle way, this dynamic interplay of these seeming opposites. And so, again, maybe calling on the positive aspect of yang, he was a quest. He was on an intellectual quest to understand life and to seek the way, So there he is, and he's doing that. He's sitting under the tree. He's beginning to have some of the openings and awarenesses that came to him that became the teachings of the Buddha. And he got way caught up in his mental stuff. I mean, he started being tortured by Mara, by his self-doubt, by self-criticism, by judgment. You know, Mara, who was, you know, kind of this hallucinogenic, you know, king of delusion, who tempted him, tried to get him to get up, and, oh, forget it. Who do you think you are sitting there trying to figure out the meaning of life? You know, how stupid of you. And so he, kind of in his wrath, Mara, this spooky, you know, apparition of Buddha's own mind, you know, doubting what he was doing. On what authority, you know, do you sit there under the Bodhi tree? Well, what did Buddha do? Again, this is the yin. He touched the earth. He touched the earth. And so there's that unification. There's, you know, the heavens, the sky, the opening, the mind, the intellect, inquiry, balanced with the earth, nourishment, solidity, yin, you know, both. This is the opportunity that we have, you know, to sit upright under our Bodhi tree, you know, and to feel this connection of Father Sky and Mother Earth, you know, of Brother Sun and Sister Moon, and all of the different permutations that that we can discover together as we release ourselves from these suppressive and limited ways of thinking about our differences and allow our differences to be nourishing. So there certainly is a lot more that I could say, but I shall at this time thank you for your kind attention and ask if there's anyone else who'd like to speak, ask, share. Beata.
In particular, women practice Zen. What difference does it make?
Well, to me, all beings benefit from the Buddha Dharma. It's such a nourishing teaching that why would we not want to share it with all of us?
Yeah, I guess what I'm asking,
you know, I actually think we don't really know that yet because it is so new. That, I mean, we are literally the first generation of mixed groups where we're doing this as men and women together. That I actually don't think we know that yet. I think that we're going to discover that together. But I think one of the troubles is because we've been so separate, you know, whenever something is forced separate, I think there's a period where there's a rebalancing, and I'm not sure now, when just the idea of women's practice, like when I think about myself as a woman, I go, well, what if my practice is coming from my being a woman, and what is just coming from, you know, I don't always identify as woman as my primary identity. You know, sometimes woman is really in the forefront, and sometimes it's not. And I don't know yet, you know? I really don't know. Do you have a thought about that?
No, I mean, just the question just came up.
Yeah. Johnny?
Two transmissions, credibility as one who has attained an insight about this. And the inferior transmission is the teacher who acknowledges that that's true. That is an inferior transmission. So when women who are practicing, who have credibility all along, are finally acknowledged, they're really just being given an inferior validation of what is the case. And to have women today to be able to stand up like Maha Prajapati and says, I have credibility, but it doesn't matter if you give me a credential, I think is very important. And what I find very interesting is that all of the ancestors that you mentioned took great issue in their time with the conventional wisdom. Every single one of them left home again. whether it was Dogen, Bodhidharma, even Buddha leaving the ascetic life and saying, I have credibility here that trumps credentials. And then reading the fascicle from Dogen that basically said that same thing. But there are no criteria that are more important than the authentic articulation of the reality of Buddha nature in one's everyday life. So I think that's very important to remember. I think as long as there are women around here, I think the conventional wisdom, the lineage, has to pay heed. The lineage has to constantly correct itself and say, we can be wrong. We can be wrong, and we can begin to be right again. So I never thought about this. I've always been part of that natural lineage. So I'm very glad you brought this up. I'm very glad I'm here tonight. If I didn't know it was going to happen. If I'd known it was going to happen, I probably would have said, eh. So I'm glad it was a surprise.
River?
Also, you have to begin to wonder with Japan, where Zen started in China and then it came to Japan. The native Shinto belief system, which occupied Japan before they had Buddhism, their main and principal deity was a woman. The most important deity was a woman. So you wonder, if there was this separation from China, why it wouldn't have been counterbalanced in Japan with their previous knowledge of the most important deity being the woman, therefore, you know, the woman should practice together. It would be integrated. You would wonder how that could have stopped.
A fine question. Thank you for bringing it to our attention. Okay.
Well, what's your feeling about, and this may be hard to answer because you're immersed in it and have been for so long, but about our maybe formal practice, which seems like it was mainly designed by men over many centuries, and so it has this flavor. Maybe monastic practice in general is mostly been men through the centuries. Do you feel at home in that, or do you feel like there's something kind of funny about it?
Well, I may go slightly over here. That is certainly something that I have thought a lot about, and that is one of the things that us women, we do talk about when we get together. You know, one of the first collections of writings that was organized about women practitioners being bodies, Susan Moon put that together, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, something like that. And it was interesting because when she made a call for these papers from various women around, Catherine's in there, Linda Ruth is in there, I mean, a lot of the women that we practice with, the senior teachers are in there. And whenever she just asked them to write about their experiences, and what she realized when the writing started coming in, that it was really about bodies, that that's what women when asked to speak about their experience as women, it began to come forward of women talking about their bodies, our bodies, which isn't always a subject. I mean, I know you and I have brought this up before. It isn't always a subject that you find in the formal writings of our traditional teachings. And so certainly, but again, it's kind of like, you know, Beata's question where, you know, I don't know if some of the struggles that I have had with the monastic form have been because I'm a woman and it's not only been men practicing, but I mean, with this kind of real young emphasis of sitting and, you know, just power through it, muscle through it, you know, even though we also have grandmother mind and Kazon and his grandmother and his, you know, so I mean, there, if you look for it, you can find this kind of yin quality. But I think Zen in particular, it sort of holds up the yang kind of as the noble principle to strive for. So what would be maybe more of the yin or just, you know, not just associating yin with woman, but how does a woman's body, is there a difference, you know? I tell you one thing, this I'll be very personal here, that the monastic system was not designed by people who go through menopause. Tell you that much. I mean, it was like so clear to me last time I was at the monastery. Like, you know, these guys, you know, have no idea what it is, you know, to bring this, you know, burning, raging body to this still place. Or maybe they do. See, this is the other side, you know? And this is why, to me, I think it's a real dynamic place that we're in, because it's very liberating for me to say that in a Buddha hall, to be able to say that and know that I'm not going to be, like, punished afterwards, I hope. But then there's the next step. Oh, you know, but what maybe men, maybe others, you know, have this experience too, you know, hormonal, the hormonal reality. So,
well, it's definitely an embodied practice.
It is.
A lot of
Yeah. And yet, I think that sometimes maybe I don't know. I really don't know, because there's a way that it's like Buddha touching the earth and Buddha receiving the food. You know, there is something about that. We say it's embodied and we say it's about the body, and yet we also deny a lot of the urges and the needs of the body in service of this, you know, transcendent experience. And but again, is that female and male? I don't know. We won't know. I don't think we're going to know for a while. I think we need to just pay attention and share notes and talk with each other about it and explore. But it may end up looking different, you know, and probably they'll look back in 100 years and go, oh yeah, that did change when it started to be integrated, you know. But really great questions, and it is time. So, did I see you? I favoritism. It's time. So, maybe we can continue over tea. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma